Good evening and welcome to another exciting episode of the Perceptive Podcast. I am Josh Beiser, your host for tonight. We got a great cast for you tonight. My guest is the owner of Pixel Trickery, and he is currently in the middle of a Kickstarter for a very interesting RPG, very atmospheric game called A House of Many Doors. Please welcome to the podcast, Harry Tufts.
Hello.
Hi, Harry. It's great to have you on tonight.
Thank you.
So, to get things going, at the time of this podcast recording, you've been doing the Kickstarter now for, I think, about 8 days.
And it's been about 8 days now. Sorry.
No, that's all right. And I can see that you've already hit your initial goal. So, definitely congratulations.
Thank you. It's been an absolutely astonishing result, really. I definitely didn't expect this at all. I'm very happy.
Awesome. And we're going to be talking about the game and your Kickstarter project throughout the cast. So, to get the ball rolling then, Harry, since this is your first time on the cast, could you tell everyone a little bit about yourself and your background?
Well, like we just said, my name's Harry Tufts. I've been thinking about game design and making games for a very long time, but I've always been more of a writer than a coder, really. I started seriously learning to code about a year ago, and I started coding this game about 9 months ago, and it's been kind of a very consuming project that's been taking up all of my time ever since. So that's it. I haven't been coding for years and years, but I've been thinking about games for that long, and I've always wanted to be able to tell stories through games, and this is kind of me attempting to do that.
Cool. Is your studio, do you have other people in your studio, or is it just a one-man studio at the moment?
Technically, it's a one-man studio. I'm doing the writing and the coding. I've got a very, very talented artist, Catherine Unger, who's not actually a part of the company. She's a freelance artist, but, she's very, very good, and she's going to be involved in the game, like, throughout the development process, and if you've seen some of her art on the Kickstarter, then it's really fantastic.
Yeah, the game definitely has an interesting look to it. I'm interested to talk to you more about that as we get more into the podcast. Now, we were actually introduced by a friend of the podcast and writer and designer for Fail Better Games, Chris Gardner, and he was talking about how you're part of the Fail Better Games incubation program.
Yes, that's right.
For people who haven't heard that before, could you tell us a little bit about that?
So Fail Better basically have set up an incubation program for very kind of small-time indie developers like me, almost exclusively for narrative-focused indie developers, I think, because that's kind of very much their wheelhouse. Basically, it's just for the last few months, I've been able to go in and sit in the corner with my laptop, and I've been able to get access to their free fruit and fudge, but more importantly, I've been talking to them and getting some really, really good advice, and they've kind of been serving as kind of these very experienced and knowledgeable mentors, basically. And they've opened their incubation program for applications for other indie devs as well. And basically the thing that they offer is, obviously they're very busy during work hours, but if you can catch them, then they will tell you some very, very kind of interesting advice that I think any indie developer would be mad to kind of turn down, because everything they say has really helped me out for sure.
Now, to get into the program, did you reach out to them or did they reach out to you?
Well, I've been kind of going along to, I met Fail Better Games at Develop Conference.
Okay.
And I spoke to them there, and I've been going along to some of their interactive fiction workshops as well, which they've been holding. I knew them for before they started thinking about the incubation as a thing they were going to do. So when they started doing it, they kind of reached out to me as to be the first person to come along. And obviously I was more than happy with that. It sounded amazing. So that's what I did. It's been such a positive experience, and anyone else who, is in the same situation as me, I'd definitely encourage them to apply. It's all on their website, I think.
Cool. I'll check that out after the cast, and I'll include a link to it.
Great. Do you want me to plug in some headphones?
So the program sounds very interesting. Is this open to, like, any indie developer, or do they have to be within, like, the Fail Better office?
Well, I think the whole point of the incubation is kind of being able to go along into the office itself and sit in the corner with the laptop and just, interact with people kind of face to face. So you'd have to be a kind of in the UK, in the London area, I suppose, to be able to benefit from it. Okay. But yeah, it's open to anyone as far as I can tell. And it's just, if you're narrative focused, in your development, you're probably more likely to be successful in your application. Mm-hmm. And you know, if they like the look of your game and they like the look of you and think that what you're doing is interesting, then they're going to probably be happy to take you in and give you some advice and take you under their wing a little bit, which has been massively beneficial for me.
Cool. And have you had a chance to meet Chris in person yet? Because I've been talking to him through email and these podcasts for the last few years.
Yeah, I've met him in person a couple of times. He's actually, he must be quite an elusive figure because he's often, you know, talking to people in the Failbetter office through Skype and stuff as well. but he has come in a few times and I've met him. He's very, very nice, obviously. He's an incredibly lovely man.
Awesome. All right. Before we talk a little bit more about your Kickstarter and what you have planned for House of Many Doors, Harry, for a little bit more background on yourself, besides making A House of Many Doors and your interest in narrative titles, are there any other genres or games that you like to play in your spare time?
Oh, yeah, loads. I've got far too many games and interests and things that I have. I mean, I've kind of played everything. I think I've played every genre under the sun a lot, apart from racing games, which I've never really been able to get into, although I do like Mario Kart occasionally. But yeah, I've got a very broad interest. I think narrative games are the thing that captured me as something I'd like to make. Mm-hmm. But in terms of what I like to play, it's very broad and, you know, anything seems good. I haven't actually been able to play many games in the last 9 months or so because so much of my time has just been spent on developments. You know, things like The Witcher 3, which looks amazing and which I really want to play, I just haven't had the time for, which has been a little bit tragic. But, you know, I've been making my own things, so that's fine.
Yeah, right now at the moment I am counting the days for when the Mario Maker game is finally out for the
Wii. I know, that looks amazing.
Yeah, someone who wants to do a lot more in terms of like mechanic and like action-based design, having be able to do something like that, even though I'm not much of a programmer, I think that's going to be a lot of fun for me. I'm sure it's going to be a lot of fun for a whole lot of people who grew up playing Nintendo.
Yeah, I went to a kind of a games conference thing in London a few days ago. And they had Mario Maker there, and I saw a little kid playing it, and he kind of been above 4 or 5, and he was just doing these incredibly creative things with blocks and Goombas and stuff.
Nice.
And I just thought, how fantastic that this game is just a creative tool set for this like little kid who, you know, he might grow up and be a game developer someday, we don't know, but he was sitting there with such an intent look on his face, I thought it was amazing.
Yeah, I mean, we could have a whole conversation about just how easy or the ease it is to get into the game industry these days compared to the 90s and pretty much the 80s. Stuff like Mario Maker is becoming a lot popular. We have Unity, Unreal. If you have the mind for programming, it's definitely far easier to get in, especially with the indie side of things. Just as yourself is a good example of that, there are a lot of examples of people going into game development, you know, through their own studio or just through themselves making a game, and it's becoming very viable as an option compared to having to, you know, force yourself to work at a AAA or AA studio, and even then there's no guarantee that you'll be able to do what you want there.
Yeah, that's very true. And I think even, you know, even 5 or 6 years ago, it was a very, very different landscape. Yeah. And obviously, that was when indies were starting to become very, very popular, but it was quite a small field still. And we have really seen an explosion in the past few years. And I think it's because, you know, it seems like it's an incredibly fast changing industry. And it's got so much creative potential that hasn't been explored. It's just really exciting for a lot of people. Mm-hmm. And, you know, who knows what the effect is going to be on the industry as a whole, given how many indies are kind of getting involved in the process recently, including me. Mm-hmm. But I think at the end of the day, I think it's fantastic because it's a lot of people who are very, very passionate and engaged exploring a very, very unique medium, which can only be a good thing, really.
Yep, definitely. All right, so with that, let's move on and talk a little bit more about what you have planned with the House of Many Doors and the Kickstarter.
Okay.
Normally with these casts, we talk about the game first and then the Kickstarter, because obviously the game is done, but right now with you, of course, we're still in the midst of the Kickstarter. So
yeah,
we'll talk about the concept of A House of Many Doors, and then I have some general questions about your thoughts on Kickstarter, and I think that will probably take us to the end of the cast.
Okay, that sounds great.
All right. So, obviously, I guess the first big question then is, for people listening, what is A House of Many Doors?
So, A House of Many Doors is an RPG focused on exploration, where you are in a train on legs, which kind of moves a bit like a centipede, mm-hmm. and you're navigating through a parasite dimension which steals things from other worlds.
Very simple game then, right? Very simple story.
Yeah, the elevator pitch is very easy to deliver very quickly.
Yeah.
But yeah, this strange dimension is called the house. It's a kind of variegated space, architectural, procedurally generated. Mm-hmm. And the idea is that you're kind of exploring and discovering new things in it and moving from place to place and discovering bits of kind of interactive fiction, which will come up, and you can do quests and things through that. One of the central parts of the game is that you're a poet and you kind of collect memories and experiences from the things that you come across. Mm-hmm. And then you can write procedurally generated poetry by combining the memories that you have.
And what do you do with the poetry once it's done?
I think it's a bit true to life in that the writing of the poetry is the most valuable thing. You just produce this poetry and it kind of serves as a weird little level up thing where producing poetry will increase your stats. Mm-hmm. And then you can also publish it and it will improve your reputation as a poet and possibly earn you a little money if you have a very good reputation. Otherwise, it will not earn you very much money at all. It's very true to life in that way.
Yep, so I was reading the description for House of Many Doors, and from what you were saying about the general gameplay of looking for these memories or inspirations to write your poetry, the game definitely sounds very similar to Sunless Sea, which is the fail-better exploration-type roguelike set in the Fallen London universe. Was that sort of like your primary inspiration for the game?
Yeah, I think it would be completely accurate and fair to say that Sunless Sea was the main inspiration for House of Many Doors. I think it was just a very, very, very good RPG/roguelike that really changed the way I thought about RPGs and made me think that I really wanted to make a similar game in, you know, telling a different story in a different setting with a lot of different kind of mechanics. Mm-hmm. But the core of exploration and moving between bits of interactive narrative, that is definitely very prevalent in House of Many Doors as well. And that is kind of what really hooks me about Sunless Sea.
Cool. So you mentioned already that the game is going to be procedurally generated.
Mm.
How much does the game, I guess, change on different playthroughs? Or what's going to be different from one play to another?
It's quite interesting the way it works in the moment, and this is something that's actually fairly simple to change, and I'm just going to have to think about what I want to do. At the moment, how it works is you start the game, and the house that it generates, because obviously the house is the place you're exploring, mm-hmm. it's all done from a random seed, which will mean it's completely the same on your computer. So the house will stay the same on your computer no matter how often you visit it, basically. Mm-hmm. But if another person opens up the house, opens up A House of Many Doors and starts a new game, it will generate a completely different house on that different PC. So everyone will have a static setting which will be different on every computer that it starts on. So everyone will have a unique setting, but it will be...
With Sunless Sea and with The House of Many Doors, I guess where did... As we said, the Sunless Sea was a good inspiration for the game, but how did you come up with the original concept at the start?
The concept of the house had been knocking around in my head for quite a while, actually. It's, you know, I think about different settings and worlds and stuff like that a lot. And that was something that I just really liked, the idea of a dimension that was actually a parasite that would lock onto other universes and kind of just leech things out of it. And I like the fact that the game at the moment is you in that dimension already, and the game never really leaves the house. The house is, you know, you don't start in a different world and then get sucked in or something. It's just, everything is in the house, including the game. Mm-hmm. And that was just a very interesting setting to me that was very, very flexible and would let me do a lot of cool things. So I thought it would be perfect for the game.
Cool. Another part of A House of Many Doors I was looking at on your Kickstarter is the combat system. And combat is definitely a very interesting thing. Whenever we have games that focus on a narrative or exploration quality, combat is typically its own like separate beast. With Sunless Sea, I know when I spoke with Chris and Liam from Fail Better, they talked about the different iterations combat went through to get Sunless Sea to how it is now. For you with A House of Many Doors, how do you see the combat system right now?
I think the combat is a very tricky thing. It's very, very hard to get right, like you said, in a game that's narrative focused. At the moment, what happens is you go into a real time with pause mode, and you can see your vehicle, which is the train with legs, and you see the enemy vehicle, and you can kind of you exchange missile fire, and it's a little bit FTL-y. Mm-hmm. I think what I'm trying to do to tie it back into the narrative, which is the core of the game, because I think, you know, mechanics should reflect narrative and vice versa, and everything should tie into itself. So what I'm trying to do, and hopefully with success, is I'm trying to tie the combat into the characters, in that when you're in this combat mode, you can see all of your characters and their health and their kind of morale, and you have to manage them. And rather than FTL, where it's a very much room-based system, where you have damage to various rooms and stuff, it's all about managing where your characters are and trying to make sure that, you know, I want my surgeon to be next to someone who's got low health so they can heal them. I want my pilot to be in the pilot room so that I can actually pilot the ship. I want my engineer to be, you know, by the engine or fixing something that's broken. Mm-hmm. And also there's a huge and hopefully scary capacity in the game at the moment for characters to be killed in combat. Mm-hmm. And the game at the moment has the crew that pilot the Kinetipede. They're a mix of procedurally generated characters who hopefully you get a bit attached to, but they will die. And also hand-designed characters with their own narrative and quests. And obviously, if they die, that's a very big thing, because you've spoken to them, they've had dialogue, and then they get killed in combat. And I'm hoping that will feed into each other, if you know what I mean. And I'm trying to design the quests for each character to incorporate the idea that you might be in the middle of someone's quest, and then they get blasted apart by artillery fire. And then I want the quest to still be able to continue in some way after that, even if it's just posthumously trying to fulfill this person's request, you know? Mm-hmm. And I think that's interesting, and it's kind of changes the narrative, and it makes the combat feel a bit more connected with everything else. And I'm hoping that will, you know, it's subject to change, because I think it's going to be a difficult balancing act to pull off, and the combat might change. But right now, I think it looks good, and I'm hoping that I'm going to be able to carry on and make it work the way it is.
Yeah, definitely. Another interesting part about what you were just saying in terms of the combat changing is the fact that, as we said with Sunless Sea, it definitely went through several iterations. It was first a turn-based system, or a quasi-turn-based, and then it became just full-on real-time on the map. So I'm curious to see how it's going to evolve with your game, because obviously with the game being in Kickstarter right now, it's still in that state of flux. Now, as we said, the game's going to be roguelike in that nature, that you have this ship, it can be destroyed, and you're going to have to restart. Are there any persistent elements you're thinking about, like, that will carry over if you die? I know Sunless Sea sort of had that with, like, mementos and leaving things behind to your family.
I actually don't think the game's going to be a roguelike, really. I think I'm going to have I think there's elements of roguelike, but the player's going to be able to make as many saves as they like. I think what's significant, you know, I don't want the player to play A House of Many Doors worrying about their own death, especially. Obviously, it will be a game over if that happens, but they can just load the latest save. What I want them to really worry about is their crew dying. Which puts them in the position of, you know, if their crew die, then it might not be enough to make them reload the game, but it's certainly enough to change the way the game is played. And that's what I want the primary tension to be.
Okay. So if the game's going to be more like an RPG or more of a general play, do you have an idea of like what a typical playthrough of the game will be? or how long?
I think at this stage it's very difficult to say. Mm-hmm. I'm hoping that a typical playthrough will be about 20 hours, possibly more, just of traveling around, exploring, finding things. I don't know. I think that's what I'm aiming for. It's going to be difficult to have kind of the 100-hour epic Skyrim thing with a game that's made by one person. But I don't want it to be a very, very short game either. I want there to be some kind of, you know, heft to it, and I want the slow process of discovering new things to be consistently exciting, and for that to be something that is going to remain something, you know, you're going to still be exploring and finding new things 10 or 15 hours into the game is what I hope. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I know what the main quest is, and I think you can probably, if you really wanted to, you could probably go through that quite quickly, but there's going to be a lot of distractions along the way that will hopefully keep you occupied.
Cool. Now, in terms of, like, progression and growing in the game, how does your ship or your crew members evolve or become stronger over a play?
At the moment, there's two different things that will track that. There's a system where you can upgrade the Kinesipede, which is the train with legs. You can add new legs, you can add armor and weapons and things like that. And that's all tied into the economy. You just buy stuff and then you upgrade it with that. And then there's the stats, which you use to... It will improve your chances for various things in combat. Mm-hmm. And it will also tie into various narrative events. So if you have higher guile, then you'll be better able to trick someone, for example. Mm-hmm. And the stats are primarily increased by writing poetry, because you know, I really want to tie that system into poetry. You know, I'm not sure that makes sense, but I think it's actually created a very fun kind of loop where you go out and you have experiences, and rather than straight up getting XP and then leveling up, you have to go and make something. You have to make a poem, and then you have that poem. Mm-hmm. And that's a nice little twist on the level up system, which I think works quite well.
Yep, sounds interesting. Now, as we said, the game is not going to be roguelike. As you say, you're going for this one experience. So... Mm-hmm. Is there, like, punishment or, like, fails? Like, if your ship gets blown up, you mentioned the crew already and how you want to keep continuing the quest if they die. But are there any failure states that you're thinking about having in the game?
Yeah, I think, you know, if the player dies, or if, like you said, the train gets blown up, then there will be a game over, and it will just be like, do you, you know, the save system is going to be limited to when you're in one of the interactive narrative rooms, because, you know, there's these rooms which you travel to which have interactive narrative, and they're cities or ruins or, you know, cathedrals or various strange things that you can explore. But then you have to travel between that and then another place like that, and along the way you'll have this kind of period of navigating through these dark rooms with things chasing you and obstacles. And in those you can't really save, so and, you know, I could very easily let people save there, but I'm kind of deliberately trying to create a bit of tension where moving from one place to another is a risk. And if you get blown up along the way, then there's a little bit of kind of player punishment of, okay, you're back to the room you started in. It's not a huge setback. I don't want to annoy people, and I don't think it feels annoying at the moment. It's just enough to make the idea of death be a little bit tense.
Give some weight to your actions, basically.
Exactly, yeah. And discourage save scumming a little bit as well.
Mm-hmm. Now, as you just say, you're going to be moving between these different rooms. You have, like, the save spots, and then you have the major part. And then you have, like, the combat, the exploration. Let's say I'm in a room, or I'm traveling, I get killed, and I restart my save. If I try to go back into that room again where I just died, does the game procedurally generate a new area? Is it, like, set on, like, new game generation? Or how does it generally work?
Well, the rooms will be the same throughout any one playthrough. If you start the game and you go to a room and then you die in that room, you'll be able to go back to that room when you reload, and it will look the same. All the same stuff will have been procedurally generated there. You know, I think that can be useful because it means you grow familiar with certain places, and then the process of discovery, you know, because there's lots and lots of rooms to explore. So you're never going to run out of new stuff. And then the fact that the things you've already seen stay the same means discovering new stuff feels more meaningful.
Another part of the game that I want to talk about, you mentioned a few minutes ago regarding the art design and how the art of the game is being done by Catherine Unger. And I just want to touch a little bit more on the art aesthetic for the game. Like, what were you, like, originally going for, like, when you told Catherine about the game? Like, how did you want A House of Many Doors to look?
I think I'm a big believer in finding the right person and letting them run with it. Okay. I spent a lot of time looking for artists. I found a couple of very, very good ones. And it was, you know, Catherine was actually someone who I'd kind of wanted from the very beginning, if you know what I mean. Yeah. I found her Twitter and I found her Tumblr, and I thought her artwork would just suit the tone of the game so perfectly. And I got in contact with her before anyone else. And it looked for a little bit as though it wasn't 100% that she was going to get involved, basically. It wasn't 100% certain. So I went to a lot of other people, and I'd had a big, you know, I had a long period where I was just going from artist to artist and looking at their stuff. And in the end, Catherine was able to come on board, and that was a huge deal for me because, like I said, that was the person I really wanted. And I think that's definitely paid off. It's very funny because I know what the places look like that I'm describing to her because I can see them very clearly in my head. So I have these kind of very strict specifications that I give her. But in terms of exactly how it looks, I just let her run with it a little bit. And she's consistently really kind of surprised and amazed me every time. And I'm hoping that continues, obviously. You know, I think I've just been very fortunate to find someone who is very willing to accommodate the mad stuff I come up with, but is also very, very good at interpreting it in her own way and putting a very distinctive, lovely style on it. So I've been very lucky to find her.
Cool. All right. I think with that, we're going to probably move on, because obviously we could talk a lot more about what you have in mind for the game, but that can obviously all change as the Kickstarter goes on, and especially once you get into the development. And
yeah.
Are there any other aspects of the game, either from a design point of view or storytelling point of view, that I haven't touched on that you would like to bring up, Harry?
I don't think so. I think there's quite a lot to the game at the moment. You know, it's been in development for 9 months already, and there's probably a lot of things that I can talk about, but I think we've hit on all the main points, really. You know, I think the procedural generation is not just the house and the setting. It's, like I said, the crew as well. There's a lot of procedurally generated crew members, and the poetry as well is something that I'm experimenting with. I don't know. I don't think that we can talk much more about that in an interesting way, but I think it's worth mentioning. That's something that I'm really interested in. I think is going to make the game quite interesting to play.
All right. The game definitely sounds interesting, Harry, and I would love to talk more about with you, but as we said, at the time of this recording, the Kickstarter is going on, and obviously things can change, not just in traditional game development, but especially through a Kickstarter-backed project. And to move the cast on to our next conversation, since this is obviously your first Kickstarter game, I want to ask you a few questions about Kickstarter as a platform and your general thoughts on it.
Okay, that sounds great.
So the first question then I like to ask all of our developers who come on who have either Kickstarters going on or have completed them is, when you were coming up with the concept for A House of Many Doors, did you think about going on Kickstarter like then, like when you were coming up with the initial concept? Or did that sort of come up while you were developing the game?
I don't think the thought of Kickstarter really entered my head at all for the first, you know, 4 or 5 months of development at least. It started out very much as something I did in my spare time. And by that, I mean all of my spare time, like, you know, kind of get in at 6 from work and then work until 3 a.m. and then go to bed and then do it again the next day for weeks. But even though I was working that hard on it, it didn't seem like a thing that I was going to ever, you know, I definitely wanted to release it at some point. I wanted other people to play it, but I wasn't really thinking about that. I was just thinking about making it at that point, and I wasn't thinking about Kickstarter until suddenly I just kind of hit a point where I suddenly thought, actually, I've made it now. Well, I've made, you know, it's playable. It's got a, you know, if you go on itch.io, it's got a it's got a demo. It's a playable game. It's just not very full of stuff to do at the moment because I need time to do that. Yeah. But once I'd made it, I thought, hang on, I really should just start actually marketing this and thinking seriously about releasing it, because I've done it now, you know. It'd be silly not to.
Yeah.
So that's when I started thinking about Kickstarter. And I thought, as a first game, I thought it would be just a very, very good idea to put it on Kickstarter. Firstly, because that way I could get enough funds to make it a very professional seeming game. If without the Kickstarter, I'd have had to use all of my own art, which, if you've seen my own art, there's still some of my art in the game at the moment on the in the demo. And it's just not very good at all.
Oh, don't worry about that. I'm not an artist either. Site designer, Ken, has kept some of my old original drawings and sketches I made for this site. And he pretty much uses that as like a horror show to scare his students. You know, this is what happens if you don't have a professional. This is that. Stare and gaze into the horror, the abyss of that.
Yeah, it's very true. And, you know, I don't think of myself as a terrible artist, in that, you know, I draw sometimes in my spare time. I'm not really bad at it. But compared to a professional, like Catherine or someone who does this for a living, it's such a world of difference. It's unreal. And my stuff just looks even worse in comparison with the kind of stuff that a professional can put out. So, the fact that I'll have, you know, because my Kickstarter's funded now, the fact that I'll have funds to actually have a professional artist involved is just going to completely change everything, I think, and really bring people in and just, you know, I've got the writing and the coding down. That's stuff that is very important. But art is also like something which makes an immediate first impression, which I don't think can be emphasized enough.
Definitely. Especially as we talked about earlier in the cast with the rise of the indie market, we see numerous indie developers either go with like a very basic style, or we've seen the rising popularity of like 8-bit or very crude pixel art for a lot of indie titles, especially a lot of first-time indie developers. And as you said, Harry, especially with Kickstarter, you really need to make a good first showing. And art is definitely up there. I mean, especially when you're trying to show someone your game, if you can't properly show them how your game's going to look or how it's going to work, no one's going to want to give you money.
Yeah, exactly.
And that actually takes me to an interesting point that I want to get your thoughts on, especially as a first-time developer and first-time Kickstarter. The big example of, I think, what not to do with Kickstarter lately would have to have been the Kickstarter for the game Mooncrest. Have you seen that Kickstarter before?
Is this... I might have. Did it have a particularly unusual video?
Yeah, it had, like, two women talking.
Yes.
Yeah. And I was watching that, and I looked at their Kickstarter, and it just did nothing for me. I actually made a post about it, talking about what elements they did that didn't work, and what they should have done. And as a good point of comparison, when I look at your Kickstarter for House of Many Doors, Harry, you have the elements that I think make up a good Kickstarter. You have the art that shows what the game's going to look like. You actually have in-game footage. Even if it is like prototype or early engine, it's still something that shows this game in action. And you have good descriptions of what you want in the game, what you have, and stuff like this. I mean, it sounds very simple. You know, it's like, I'm just talking about my game. But I've seen so many first-time developers or people going to Kickstarter, and they just, you know, fail. They can't stick the landing, in a manner of speaking, when they're setting up their Kickstarter pledge or the Kickstarter pitch. When you were coming up with this Kickstarter, how long did you spend, I guess, planning out the campaign before you actually, you know, flipped the switch and said, okay, Kickstarter's now up?
Well, you know, like I mentioned, I spent 6 months working on the game without thinking about this stuff. But then I really started thinking about this stuff. And I think it was a solid month of very, very intense preparation for the Kickstarter. I didn't actually get much development done for a month because I was focusing so much on trying to build any kind of buzz. And it felt like it wasn't paying off, to be honest. It felt every step of the way like no one's interested. Yeah. Oh, my God. But then I think it did pay off. I mean, it was really, really important that I did that. And I think if you go on Kickstarter without having done preparation, then I think maybe that would have worked out for you 2 years ago, but in the current climate, when people have seen Kickstarters fail, it's not a good idea at all, I don't think.
Exactly. That's just what I said in my post, and what I've been saying now for like the last year, that Kickstarter really is beyond that quote-unquote gold rush period set by Double Fine, Uber Entertainment, a lot of those Kickstarters where you didn't need a lot to pitch because everyone was so excited about the platform. But we're seeing more and more examples of Kickstarters that either A, fail to deliver on the game, B, just outright crash. You know, they get the money and then they just fail to put anything out. And this all hurts the consumer conception of it. If the game that you just backed failed, you know, you gave them $50, why the hell would you give someone else $50 and, you know, go around, you know, the same show again?
Yeah, exactly. And obviously there's been a lot of great games that have been released on made through Kickstarter. Definitely. But I can really imagine that someone who 2 years ago put their money on something, one of the ones that crashed and burned, you know, that's someone who's probably lost to Kickstarter forever, because if you've done that once, then why would you come back?
Exactly. And the problem, I think, this is a whole topic I don't think we'll have time to get to today, but a major problem, I think, is just the general lack of information or lack of detailed information on how game development works. Many consumers still don't really understand how a game is made or what goes into making a video game. And Kickstarter has opened up the doors, in a manner of speaking. It's made things a little bit more transparent. Obviously, with your Kickstarter and with other Kickstarters, you tell them, you know, I need this amount of money. It's going to be going for A, B, C, and D. I'm planning on working this amount of time. And that's a great first step, but there's still so many elements of game development that people don't quite understand. I mean, we can talk about mechanics and design, you know, until the cows come home. I mean, hell, I've had 3-4 hour conversations on this cast talking about game design. And so much of, I think, the conception or preconception of Kickstarter is the fact that, as you said, Harry, if you donate to a Kickstarter and it fails, your chance of donating to another one is going to be drastically less. Even though these are completely different games, completely different teams, many people just view it as apples to apples, when that's just really not the case.
Yeah, I think that's very true. I think, you know, there's a lot of different things that you have to have for a successful Kickstarter, and you know, that's things like a playable demo is incredibly useful, especially for a first time indie like me, because it shows that you've actually got something. Yeah. And like you said, footage of actual gameplay, and, you know, an enticing description, try and sell people on the game rather than just describing it.
Yeah.
And, you know, be very honest throughout the whole thing, and just, you know, lay out a plan which people will look at and think that's achievable rather than think you're shooting for the moon, you know?
Exactly. Yeah, and that actually takes me into another question I want to ask you about, Harry, with the Kickstarter. As you just said, a lot of what makes a good Kickstarter work is the planning, understanding what your limitations are, et cetera, et cetera. With the Kickstarter to A House of Many Doors, one thing that I'm just going to do a quick look now just to confirm what I was thinking. Oh, yeah, one thing that I noticed about the Kickstarter is that you don't have any real stretch goals for it. And this is one of those very polarizing topics among both Kickstarter developers and backers themselves, because we've seen cases both for and against having, you know, stretch goal on top of stretch goal, etc., etc. Are you planning on doing any stretch goals or announcing any ideas as Kickstarter goes on, or is this pretty much, or is like the original concept going to be it for the Kickstarter pitch?
I think that the thing with stretch goals is that they're a very good way of encouraging people to fund you slightly more if you've already been funded successfully. I think one definite no-no with stretch goals is I don't think any Kickstarter should launch with stretch goals already in place. I think that gives entirely the wrong impression.
Yeah.
But in terms of once you've been funded, I think there's for and against for stretch goals, and I'm not 100% against them. But personally, I think I'm not going to have stretch goals for my Kickstarter.
Yeah.
For a variety of reasons. I think, firstly, I don't want to overcommit to something, which then turns out to be a really, you know...
Of course,
If I say... if I say for an extra, you know, £2,000 or something, then I can do something massive and add a huge amount of more content. You know, I'm on a schedule at the moment, which is very meticulously planned out. And if I just suddenly add to that,
yeah,
it could have ramifications for, you know, delaying the game
or something.
Yeah. I don't particularly want that to happen. And, you know, the amount of extra funding I might get would be very nice. And it would probably help the game a lot. But I don't think it would compensate the possible ramifications that could have.
Of course, yeah. And that goes back to what we were just saying a few minutes ago regarding the mysteries, or quote-unquote mysteries, of game development. You can make people think that, if I give you $10,000, I expect the game to be $10,000 better. But that's never really the case. And as you said with the stretch goals, each one of these is onto itself a whole nother headache and challenge for you to add to your game. The example that I think made me really disappointed was Planetary Annihilation. They had an original goal of, I think, $250,000, and they got, I think, over $2 million, I believe. It's been a while, but they had like 8 or 9 different stretch goals, and some of them were there before they even started the project. And just as you said, that can lead to its own headache, especially when you're playing this budget. I mean, if you start a Kickstarter with goals, how do you plan your schedule? Do you plan with the goals in mind? Do you plan without? Because as you said, it gives a different connotation when you start with stretch goals, as opposed to saying, you know, we're 3 weeks into the Kickstarter, we already made our money, but, you know, we have a few little ideas left, you know, on the cutting room floor.
Yeah, and I think if you start with stretch goals, then people who back will want those stretch goals to be fulfilled, because the stretch goals were there from the beginning. And if they're not fulfilled, then they'll maybe feel like they're getting a lesser game than they were hoping for, which is the opposite of what you want with a Kickstarter. You want people to think they're getting the game they wanted when they put money on it.
Exactly. And with the Planetary Annihilation Kickstarter, a lot of those stretch goals were really like game-altering elements. They had like different planets that would alter how strategy was. The big one that was also, I think, their biggest flop, in my opinion, was their single-player Galactic War campaign, which just it didn't enter with a bang. It just entered with a dud, and a lot of people complained about that. And this was one of their major goals. I mean, I think this was like a 1 million or 1.2 million goal that. It just really sucked. I think I could say a whole lot worse about it. But as you said, Harry, what happens when you have that major stretch goal, and guess what? It just is horrible, or you can't get it to work right, and you've already committed, saying, you know, give me $50,000 and I'm going to make this. What happens when that doesn't work, and now you're left with this square peg in a round hole situation of trying to fit it into your game or into your original concept?
Exactly, and a lot of the time, these stretch goals are huge things, like you said, that really change the entire way the game is played and a lot about the game's design. And a lot of game development is deciding, actually, this doesn't work at some point in the process. And once you've put a stretch goal down, and I think a lot of the time stretch goals don't have enough forethought before they're, you know, put in the Kickstarter. And once you've put the stretch goal down and people have pledged money to see that in the game, you're completely committed to it.
Exactly.
And there's no way of going back, even if it turns out to be a horrible design decision.
Yep. And then you're basically, you know, doomed if you do, doomed if you don't. There's nothing you can really do to get around that fact.
Yeah, exactly. I think, you know, what I said with A House of Many Doors is any further funding I get above the total, above the amount that I wanted originally, is going to pretty much all go towards art and polish and just making the game look and feel and sound as nice as possible. And, you know, there's no real upper limit to what could be spent on doing that.
Of course, you can spend, you know, millions of dollars on art. I mean, especially, you know, high quality art takes time, and really you can put as much money as you want into it.
Yeah, exactly. You know, I'm not going to put a stretch goal of completely changing the way the game is played. I just think more funding will just give me a lot more leeway to change. You know, it'll really help the game, but I don't want to commit myself to doing something you know, really extreme that might get a lot of backers if I said, you know, if I'm going to put a stretch goal in where you can go to another world and leave the house and
completely
explore
new
this other world entirely.
You know, completely new the whole deal.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, that might be really exciting and get me a lot more funding, but it would be a detriment to the game itself, ultimately. So I don't want to do that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Another part of Kickstarter that I want to get your thoughts on, Harry. One thing that we see is another nail in the coffin that some developers fall in the trap of is setting a really low Kickstarter goal and then hoping that through stretch goals, through word of mouth, that they actually hit the number that they really want. But they set a low goal just to get, you know, some funding. They may need, you know, $60,000, but they may set the Kickstarter at 32 or 25. And this is another, I think, huge no-no that we're seeing. Especially, I think it's led to a lot of Kickstarters floundering or not delivering what they promise.
Yeah, I think this is, you know, this is a point that I think you're completely right about, but that my heart bleeds a little bit for developers who do
definitely.
That because it's not like the stretch goal thing where I think a lot of that is to do with making an unwise decision. I think when you have a very low Kickstarter goal, it's because you've recognized that the Kickstarter gold rush is over now.
Yeah.
And you are desperately trying to make a game and you just want to get some funding together, like you said. And, you know, it can be very, very, you know, I think people's perceptions of how much games cost to make has been slightly warped by Kickstarter. Mm-hmm. And I think people expect it to cost less than it actually does. For the most part, people, I think, are very, very switched on and engaged and intelligent and know, you know, they can tell a lot about how viable a Kickstarter is just by looking at it. But one area where I think people's perceptions are slightly out of skew is the cost.
Exactly.
So it's a very difficult situation. I'm quite lucky because I did have a very low Kickstarter goal for a game, you know, especially for an open world RPG type game.
Mm-hmm.
But I've also secured a little bit of partial funding from Failbetter, which means that I've got a very kind of coherent budget and plan of, you know, this is why I need this amount of Kickstarter funds and why I can make a game, even though it doesn't seem like very much necessarily.
Yep.
And if I, and yeah, and I don't know, you know, if I hadn't done that, then it would have been much more difficult for me. So it's a very difficult situation.
Yep. And that's a good segue into this next question, or this next part of Kickstarter that I want to get your thoughts on, Harry. As you just said, when a Kickstarter, like the pricing or the cost of development is still very much up in the air, and one thing that we see is that it's very hard to have a standard of pricing, not just with game development, but with Kickstarter goals as well. Over 2015, we've seen Kickstarters from major developers. There was the one from the man who did Castlevania Symphony of the Night. And then there was, I forget their name. The ones from the Banjo-Kazooie Kickstarter. Kukulele? Something
yes.
like that.
Yeah.
And those Kickstarters are very impressive looking. I mean, they have, like, with the Banjo-Kazooie one, they have like a full 3D engine, the game looks amazing and all that, and they were only asking like $250,000. But the problem with that is that they're receiving outside funding. They have a publisher, they have people giving, they have outside investors. The same with Bloodborne from a developer of Symphony of the Night. I'm sorry I'm not saying his name because I know I'm going to butcher it horribly, so I'm just going to refer to him as that. But the point is that these are Kickstarters that they're asking very low amounts of money for what they have planned because they have this outside funding. I know that you said a few seconds ago that Kickstarter backers today are very much keyed on, or they're a little bit more scrutinizing Kickstarters these days. But there's still that general problem or that general misconception that if these guys can make a game like Lukulele or Shenmue 3 for like $400,000 or $250,000, then when they look at someone else's Kickstarter where they're asking either similar or comparable money, they're like, you know, why can't you do full 3D engines for this amount of money or whatever? And it's kind of hard to understand that some developers do get outside funding, and that not, this goes back to what I said earlier, it's not really an apples-to-apple comparison with Kickstarter projects.
Yeah, I think that's completely right, and I think that is probably, you know, it's probably a big part of it, and it's one of those things where there's no easy answer, there's no easy way to change people's perception, and in one fell swoop kind of make everyone understand the, and, you know, because it's, you know, people only have a certain amount of time in their day, and
exactly.
You know, people like us who are very interested in Kickstarters and the way that they work and function, mm-hmm. we will, you know, we will research and think, oh, this one has outside funding, that's why it can be afford to be made for this and this amount.
Exactly.
But, you know, if you're not interested in that, then you're not going to do that research. And I think it's, you know, it's not really reasonable to demand that everyone do. So I don't know how you go about changing that perception, but it's certainly one that exists, and it's certainly one that I think is more harmful for small Kickstarters mm-hmm. than we'd want it to be. I think, yeah. You know, these very large Kickstarters, especially for things like Shenmue 3, I think those games could be made without the Kickstarter funding, but it's just in some ways a marketing thing.
Mm-hmm.
And that's another thing that, you know, it's a free country. You can't stop them from doing that. And it's clearly a very good tactic because it's generated a lot of positive buzz around Shenmue 3. But it is stopping smaller developers' ability to, you know, have these kind of much smaller, possibly, you know, more innovative games being made. And
mm-hmm.
yeah, it's difficult, but yeah, it's just a market reality at the moment.
Yep. Definitely a great point, Harry, and it's been a great time talking with you this afternoon. I always love to have these casts when we can just get into a really good rapport, and we've had some really great conversations, and I can feel that if we don't start to wrap things up, we could run like 2-3 hours long.
And yeah, definitely.
I know that you're in the UK right now, so I think, is it a 5 or 6 hour time difference where you are?
I have no idea. It's fairly late at night over here, though.
Yeah. I know when I talk with Chris, we have to be really careful because he has a family, so we don't want to wake his family up when we're doing these podcasts. So there's definitely a lot more to talk about with Kickstarter and A House of Many Doors, but I have a few just general wrap-up questions I want to get your thoughts on, and then we will say goodbye for this cast.
Okay, that sounds great.
So the first one, obviously, as we've talked about with Kickstarter, is a very viable form of crowdfunding. And another aspect behind, or another part of crowdfunding, has been early access and Steam. And I was just wondering, for you, Harry, and with House of Many Doors, are you planning on looking at, like, Greenlight or early access to put the game up on Steam?
Yes, very much so. I think one of the things that I want to do with The House of Many Doors is update it periodically after release,
mm-hmm.
which means that Steam is a really, really good option for me just because it makes that easier than any other distribution platform does at the moment.
Mm-hmm.
So at the moment, I've got a Greenlight campaign running, and I'm very, very keen to see the game get on Steam. In terms of early access, that's an open question at the moment. I'm in two minds about it, and I've heard different advice from different people. So. You know, it's something that I'm definitely considering, and I'm not 100% sold on.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And that is a very interesting topic. I've spoken with other developers. I spoke with Cliff Harris from Positech, Zach Barth from Zachtronics, and everyone has their own different thoughts on early access. The general conception that I hear, or general perception that I hear from developers, is that if your game is going to be open-ended or roguelike or something that's meant to be replayed, you know, multiple times, early access is a great way to test the game out, get impressions, and basically get a lot of eyes on your project. But if you're going for a narrative game or something that's meant to be played once, maybe twice, having people basically get to look at your entire story before the game's out may sully them on when the game is at its best later on when they have to replay the entire story over again.
Yeah, I think that's true in both cases. Mm-hmm. I'm a little bit open world and a little bit replayable.
Yeah.
Or my game is rather, not me. So, you know, I feel like I'm a little, you know, I've got points from one and points from the other that I could go for. But I think I'm leaning towards not going on early access right now. That's definitely not a promise, so don't hold me to that. But I'm leaning towards not, because narrative is the main focus of the game, and that's not. And I think you're right in that early access is more damaging to narrative based games. Well, not damaging, but it's not the wisest decision for narrative based games.
Mm-hmm. Oh, right. I have a few, I guess, quick rapid fire questions for you on your thoughts on Kickstarter, and then I got my, I guess, general big final question for you.
Okay.
So the first one is, as we talked about on Kickstarter, or as we talked about Kickstarter over this cast, the Gold Rush period is definitely over for a lot of Kickstarters, and we've seen a lot of people talk about the quote-unquote bubble bursting for using Kickstarter, especially for small developers. As we were just saying with like Bloodborne and Yooka-Laylee, they're using it more as a marketing campaign as opposed to someone like yourself or like a smaller studio who's literally using this money to keep the lights on and, you know, keep everyone, you know, keep their house going, basically.
Mm.
So, in your opinion, Harry, do you think that Kickstarter is still a viable option or will remain a viable option for indie developers? Or do you think that something may have to change in the future on that regard?
I think it's a viable option. I think, you know, I've personally been successful with Kickstarter and I'm a small developer. So I think, you know, I think it's more difficult now and you have to really, really think about it and make sure that everything is pitched as well as you can. But I don't think, you know, I think this is probably a more sensible state of affairs, to be honest. You know, 2 years ago when people were getting $2 million for very, very basic concepts, I think that was actually, that was the crazy thing. Yeah. You know, the state it's in now is the same thing where people get money for having established reputations or being very well prepared and showing that they can use it well. I think this is actually, you know, it's in some ways it's sad because there are people who are going on Kickstarter and failing who probably deserve to succeed. Mm-hmm. But also the reverse was true 2 years ago, I think.
Yeah. And I think it's going to be interesting to see really how this latest batch of Kickstarter developers, especially like yourself, how they're going to succeed in the Kickstarter market today. Because I think that's going to really set the precedent for what Kickstarter can use or what's, like, I guess, a very loose set of standards of what could be a successful Kickstarter project and a successful game from Kickstarter. Let's see. I'm trying to think if there's any other Kickstarter. Again, we could, if I start rambling, we could talk for another hour. But I'm trying to think if there's anything just directly related to you and House of Many Doors with Kickstarter. For you, Harry, and as you said, you spent some time looking at Kickstarter and developing the project. Obviously, it's probably a little too early to ask this question, but I always like to ask this one as well. In your opinion, are there any elements of your Kickstarter campaign that you think you did really well that if someone like a student or enthusiast was listening, that they could sort of learn from your example of what you did with The House of Many Doors?
I think I'd point to the fact that I had spent a couple of months beforehand, you know, I had a web with a website and a devlog and, you know, I spent a lot of time beforehand just kind of trying to get my name out on, various different platforms and just, you know, preparing basically.
Yeah.
And I think that, and also, you know, I telegraphed well in advance that the Kickstarter was going to happen. I think a month, you know, a month beforehand, as I started preparing, was when I started saying to everyone, 2nd of September, 2nd of September, that's the date you have to keep in mind. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I think that genuinely just pays off. And I don't think that's the I don't think that's a surefire route to success, but it just gives you the best chance you can get is just to prepare. And I'm really glad that I did.
Cool. And this is definitely one question that's probably too soon to ask, but it sort of follows up with that one. Were there any elements that you think you could have done better or any traps that you studied that anyone else listening, it would be a good idea to point that out as a red flag to avoid if they're setting up their own Kickstarter?
I think there probably are a lot of mistakes that I've made because I generally tend to make mistakes in things that I do. But I think it is a bit too early to tell for sure. I think my video probably could have been better. Mm-hmm. I'm not a video editor, and I kind of had to learn all of that on the fly. You know, I just tried to make it as honest and straightforward as possible. But I've seen some really, really lovely creative videos on Kickstarter that really sold me on the game and were really, really kind of just popped, and just people clearly put obscene amount of work into them. And I think that probably helps a lot, because videos are the thing that people often pay most attention to. Yeah. So, you know, if that's not beyond your reach, then I'd say spend a lot of time on the video. I did spend a lot of time on the video, but I could only me spending a lot of time on the video was just to make a decent video rather than to make a good one, because I was learning everything from scratch. Yeah.
And that's a good point of comparison to when I spoke with the guys from Red Hook Games who did The Darkest Dungeon. They told me they actually spent 6 months of planning the Kickstarter out, putting together that video and the whole deal. And that, I think, was a perfect example of a video selling the concept. It was just 2 minutes of in-game engine footage talking about how, you know, the general style of the game. And that won over a lot of people. It certainly won me over when I saw that video.
Yeah, that's the kind of thing that really, if you really, really want to have the absolute best chance of success, and you've got the time and the money and the experience to do that kind of thing, that is just, I think that is going to really make a difference. And, you know, it's something that I would have liked to have done in an ideal world, but, you know, I'm just one person and I'm not especially video editor savvy. So I did what I could.
Mm-hmm. All right. And then just a few quick logistics-related questions for you about House of Many Doors, Harry, and then we'll start to wrap things up.
Okay.
For the people listening to the cast right now, how long, or do you have a estimated time for when the game will be released? Obviously, the game's going to be Kickstarter. It's going to be funded. But once that's all said and done, do you have an idea of when the game will be out?
The game will be out in July 2016.
Okay. And obviously, you talked about Steam. Are there any other platforms that you're hoping for or aiming to get the game on?
I'm certainly going to release it on itch.io, and I'm hoping to also release it on Humble Store and maybe GOG as well. I think GOG is a bit more difficult to get onto, so we'll see about that. But Humble Store, itch.io, and Steam are the things I'm aiming to release on.
Okay. Is the game going to be PC exclusive, Mac, Linux, you know, those other versions?
It's PC and Mac. I'd love to do a Linux version, but I don't think I have the time to learn how to. I think it's a bit more difficult with the engine I'm using. So I'd like to. I'm probably going to spend a week trying to at some point in development, but I can't guarantee it at all. PC and Mac is what it's going to release to.
All right. And my last question then for you for this cast, Harry. For the people listening, do you have any final thoughts on what we've talked about, or anything you'd like to say to the fans listening? Just, you know, final words from you to end the cast on.
I think my final words would be that it's a fairly big, scary world for indie developers at the moment, but it's still, you know, it's still worth getting into because it's such a unique and amazing experience, and it's worth doing just because, you know, like any creative endeavor, you might not be completely successful, but it will change you just to do it. And I'd encourage anyone to get involved.
Awesome. All right. So I think with that, we're going to wrap things up. For those of you listening, I know this is going to be a little bit one of our shorter casts, but as we said, there is a time difference and we could just sit here and talk for 4 to 5 hours, but I'm pretty sure Harry has to get to sleep at some point today. I don't want to keep him up too much. So, as we said, the Kickstarter is 8 days in. It's going to end on October 2nd of 2015, for those of you listening to this recorded. So make sure to check it out. I'll be sure to include links to, there should be obviously a link to it in our podcast notes below. So, Harry, it has definitely been a pleasure talking to you. I'm glad Chris introduced us, and hopefully we can have you back on either as a general podcast guest or talk more about the game as we get closer to that July 2016 release.
Either of those sound fantastic. It's been really great speaking to you, Josh. Thank you.
Not a problem. And again, congratulations on the Kickstarter. As we said, it can be a little scary doing Kickstarter, especially in today's market. But it's great to hear that not only is the game going to be funded, but you've already gone above your goal. So hopefully things will work out for you, and I can't wait to see the game in July.
Thank you very much. That's really kind. Thank you.
Not a problem. So for those of you listening, we're going to wrap things up here. As always, if you'd like to contribute to Game Wisdom, we have several options currently available. If you would like to, if you'd like to write a guest piece for the site or be a future podcast guest, and we are looking for anyone, be it student, enthusiast, or game developer, you can find information and links under Submissions Wanted on the front page. If you'd like to contribute to our Patreon campaign to secure some much-needed monthly funding to keep everything running, you can find me on Patreon under Josh Beiser or Game Wisdom, or via the Patreon banner on the front page, and any donations would be greatly appreciated. And lastly, be sure to check out our Twitch channel that is under GW Beiser nightly at 10 Eastern, where I'll be streaming a variety of games, talking about their design, and just generally having a good time and trying not to die too much while playing them. And those videos will be uploaded to the Game Wisdom YouTube channel, which you can find simply by typing Game Wisdom in on YouTube. So again, thanks a lot for tuning into this episode of the Perceptive Podcast. Have a great rest of the week, and we will talk to you again next time. Take care, everybody.